This is the cycling podcast at the 2025 Vuelta a España, proudly supported by Lloyds. Thanks to sponsorship from Lloyds, we've got cycling covered. Last week was one of the busiest weeks of the cycling year, as we covered the Vuelta in Spain and the Lloyds Tour of Britain, which finished in Cardiff on Sunday, an event which also brought down the curtain on Geraint Thomas's glittering career in fine style. The Lloyds Tour of Britain is the largest free-to-attend sporting event in the UK, as well as being the country's most prestigious bike race. And across the week, there were thousands and thousands of spectators on the roadside. The crowds at Burton Dassett Country Park, on the Tumble, and especially in Cardiff were huge. Lloyds' sponsorship of British cycling is driven by a desire to inspire people of all ages to embrace the joy of cycling. We can't all win the coveted Lloyds Tour of Britain green jersey, but we can all experience and enjoy the feeling of exploring the countryside or getting from A to B on two wheels. Lloyds, there at every stage. Now let's find out the latest from Spain with Daniel.
You are listening to the cycling podcast at the 2025 Vuelta a España. Celebrating 10 years of the cycling podcast on the ground every day at the Grand Tours.
Daniel Rivas, buenas tardes.
Buenas tardes, Don Daniel.
Don Daniel, I'm not sure I deserve that title. Danny, what an extraordinary scene. I've been covering professional cycling for longer than should have been the case, probably, and I've never seen a scene like this. It compares vaguely to the summit of Mount Etna, which where I've been several times in the Giro d'Italia. But for those who didn't watch the stage today and are only just catching up now, well, first of all, we should describe the smell.
It's the closest thing to a burnt smell.
Yes.
Let's say, because everything we're seeing right now in front of us is like a mountain that has been burned during the last month here in Spain, which is El Alto del Morradero here next to Ponferrada, and the smell is like that, burnt.
It is. We heard yesterday, didn't we? We talked about the amount of land in the province of Ourense, where we are, which has been burnt, which has been affected by forest fires in the last couple of months. What did we say? It was equal to the area of Madrid, 87,000 football pitches. And it's a kind of a tragic scene, but a tragically beautiful scene in a way as well. As I said, completely unique in terms of the look of the landscape now, the look of the mountainsides. Where we're specifically, what we're looking over currently are the disused chair lifts or ski lifts of El Morradero, the ski resort that did used to be a ski resort up here. It has now fallen into disrepair. And yes, we can see these, well, we're sitting sort of at the back of a corrugated iron shed, looking out over these disused ski lifts. The good news, the really good news from today, and we didn't think this was going to be the case, was that we had a race, a full race, and an exciting race. Now, the events of yesterday weren't the only reason why we didn't think the we might not get a full stage today. Also today, from this morning, we heard reports of a very high wind, strong winds up here on El Morradero. It's still pretty windy, isn't it, Danny?
Is it pretty windy, but not maybe as windy as the reports were saying this morning, or as windy as it was this morning, actually.
We thought we might have the finish line move to the bottom of the climb, and this seemed like, well, it's the latest. It seemed like it was going to be the latest in a catalogue of misfortunes that have befallen this year's Vuelta a España. A race that almost seems cursed in the same way that I've done other Grand Tours before, which seemed cursed in different ways, but to a similar extent, the 2011 Giro d'Italia comes to mind. But we made our way, so we're going to go back in time as we always do, to this morning. We haven't said who, should we say, we usually spoiler who wins the stage early on in the episode. So let's do that. Let's tell you that we did have a race. We had an exciting race. We had minimal gaps on general classification, certainly among the top few positions, but we had a significant stage winner because Giulio Pellizzari, the young Italian prodigy, he was able to get away. Obviously, he's wearing the white jersey here as well. He was able to get away and win alone atop El Morradero. Pretty significant result, I would say, for Italian cycling, if not for the rest of the Vuelta a España. Having said that, and having hopefully whetted our listeners' appetite for what we're going to tell them later on about what happened in the stage, We are going to go back to this morning. Tell the listeners, where were we, Danny, this morning?
We were this morning at Obarco de Valdeorras, which is a place between, let's say, Orense and Ponferrada, located here not so far from the finish line, but, of course, a very, very little town in comparison with Ponferrada, which is the biggest city of the region.
And it was raining there. It was typical. What is the word in the Basque? Sirimiri, they call it. This sort of mist. It's half mist, half rain.
Yep.
And it was a pretty deserted start. Not too many people there, and a pretty wet scene. We knew that Egan Bernal was going to have some kind of presentation celebration of the stage he won yesterday with no podium celebration. But it wasn't a very sort of raucous or festive scene, was it? It wasn't a very festive start.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't. There was this kind of rain, you say, this tirimiri cala bobo or bayou, like Galicians say it. So yeah, it was not that great atmosphere, let's say, at the beginning of the day. But I think it was just worth after what we saw at the finish. We talk about it soon, but let's talk first. What we did this morning.
We arrived at the start, we heard about the winds, but we also heard about another threat to today's stage. And this was one that we were expecting. Obviously, everyone by now will know what happened on yesterday's stage, a further neutralization an abridgment of yesterday's stage. The finish line was moved, Egan Bernal won. This was because of the pro-Palestine protests close to the finish line, which we talked about at length yesterday. The threat today, was obviously for more protests, and this had been a subject of conversation and debate among riders on their various groups overnight and this morning. In fact, when we got to the start, we heard that the riders may indeed take matters into their own hands, shall we say. Let's hear from one of those riders, Jack Haig of Bahrain Victorious, about exactly what that meant.
Unfortunately, it's a bit of an unfortunate circumstances that I feel as though the Welter and us as riders have sort of been caught in the middle of something that maybe doesn't even really involve us. And at the moment, we are kind of just being the pawns in a very large chess game that unfortunately is affecting us. And in the end, there's free speech, and I really respect this. It's just a shame that it's affecting us. Yesterday, it started to become a little bit uncomfortable because there was some acts to maybe deliberately try and harm the riders by cutting down trees, by putting the thumbtacks on the ground to give deliberate flat tires, and it is now starting to get a little bit uncomfortable. The annoying thing is that I think there's a lot of people hoping that the powers above us, and even like the race organizer maybe as well, that they would step in and make a decision, because it's very difficult for us as the riders to try and decide something. Because at the end, this is quite different from an extreme weather protocol or something like this, where this does involve the riders, whereas now the situation is quite maybe over our heads. But yes, there was a vote, and the vote was that we would like to continue racing, but we don't believe continuing racing the way that it's happened yesterday is the correct way, because in the end, we kind of take away the integrity of fair sport by not really knowing where the start line is, but especially not really knowing where the finish line is. So we decided that if there is an incident, that we would try to neutralize the race, and then that would be it, because in the end, racing to an undefined finish line is not really fair sport.
And do you think you can actually agree on that on the road?
In the end, 23 teams voted, and this was the outcome. But to see it in practice, unfortunately, we know from history that generally we are not good at making decisions collectively in a race situation. And this is the hard thing for us as cyclists now, that it would be very nice that if there was the commissaire or someone that was outside of us as the riders in race situation that could make these decisions for us, because yeah, we are not in the right mindset at the end of the day to make those kind of critical decisions in a race.
Can you explain to those who don't know, you talked about the vote. How does this take place? What's the medium on which it takes place, and who is voting?
So there's a CPA riders group, and for every single race, there's an email that's sent around, and you get a link to join a Telegram group. And every rider that is involved in, for example, La Vuelta a España is free to join the group. Not everyone is inside the group, but there is also a CPA delegate and as well as Adam Hansen, the president of the CPA, is involved as well. And then there was a lot of discussion on this group, and everyone needed to select one representative from each team to then get put in another Telegram group where there was a poll taking place. And basically...
Last night.
I believe it was this morning, actually. The poll was taking place this morning. In the end, there was 23 votes on this poll, and the outcome was that, yeah, if there was any incident today that disrupts racing from normal racing, that we would neutralize the race.
And final thing, that's just for today. That doesn't affect the stages to come.
No, so the vote was clearly just for today, and then I think it'll be taken on a day-to-day basis as to what happens. But I think collectively everyone would really like to arrive to Madrid under normal circumstances. Obviously, we need to take it day by day and try to respect as much as possible still the sporting event that is going on, but obviously there is now a few incidents which is sort of taking it away from being just a fair sporting event and where the riders are safe.
Very last thing, was it a close vote?
No, so there was three options on the vote, and then there was a separate vote to decide whether we would agree with the majority or whether it had to be 100%. So, and in the end, there was a clear winner of the three options, and people agreed that they would respect the majority vote.
That was Jack Haig about some of the sort of mechanics of the resolution made by the riders this morning. Now, I was hoping that we would hear tonight from the CPA president himself, Adam Hansen. We still may hear from him in the course of this episode. I'm expecting a call from him at any time, in fact. But I believe that what the riders had decided was going to be put to the commissaires. Fortunately, it wasn't necessary in the sense that we didn't have any of the protests or disturbances that we had yesterday. Danny, I know I spoke to various riders this morning, you did as well, and you spoke to one of the CPA representatives here, Simone Petilli.
Yeah, which is, besides that, one of the riders who actually suffered a crash after the protests. And yeah, Simone just was telling me that, let's say, kind of taking off responsibilities in the sense of they are not the people who should decide what to do. They're the La Vuelta and UCI responsibility. And besides that, a very interesting thing he said is that he's not a star of the sport. I mean, he's not a big name in the sport, and I think, or he thinks, better to say, that responsibility has to be taken by those big names on cycling.
Also this morning, I think the general feeling that I got from the riders was that they were exasperated at being exposed to danger, and they're exasperated at being in, it seemed to them, the main decision makers in this process. Or obviously they want a say in matters, but I think a lot of them feel as though they are isolated at the moment. We talked last night about the lack of sort of action and mainly presence from the UCI on this matter, and that seemed to continue today. Again, we may revisit this later in the episode, and we may yet hear from Adam Hansen. But Danny, let's proceed now to talk about what did happen on the road in the race in today's Jamonómetro.
El Jamonómetro de Michele Pelacci.
How many jamones, please, for today's stage?
I'm going to be quick today. 4 out of 5.
4. I think that's very fair. I think it almost deserves an extra jamón because we were worried that we weren't going to get a full stage, and we did get a full stage. The stage was to start, and did indeed start, from Obarco de Valdeoras, and we were going to where we are now, the Alto del Moredero. In the general classification, Jonas Vingegaard still led João Almeida by 48 seconds. Tom Pidcock was third, 2 minutes 38 seconds down. And Jai Hindley was 4:03:10 down. I won't go any further than that. Interestingly, we heard from Jack Haig earlier. I wanted to mention that Jack Haig was completing today, and thanks to Pro Cycling Stats for this, he was completing today his lap of the globe in Grand Tours. He, as of today, had raced in excess of 39,990 kilometres in Grand Tours. That equated to 250 stages in 15 Grand Tours. The first, so well done, Jack, I should say. First significant group to go was of five riders, including Mads Pedersen. They became seven when the Ineos pair of Sheffield and Kwiatkowski made it across. Incidentally, Michał Kwiatkowski today was refamiliarizing himself with the circuit, certain roads that were on the World Championship course where he won in 2014. That move, however, was quickly neutralized or snuffed out. The next big move was of the following riders: Rivera, Michels, Tiberi, Tejada, Gamper, Van Boven, Horsen, Gregor of Lotto. They would soon be joined by Lemmerizer, Samitier, Lozue, and Nicolau. We were moving into the Bierzo territory or comarca, another land which produces fine wines. We were in one this morning because we were still staying in our lovely monastery in the Ribera wine region. We drove through Ribera Sacra on the way to the start, and we were moving into Bierzo, another wonderful wine producing region. With 100 kilometers to go, the gap to those chaps out of the front was only 1 minute and 45 seconds, so they haven't gone too far. But it was windy out there. With 77 kilometers to go, briefly the peloton was even splitting in the winds. There was a king of the mountains, well, there was a third category climb with 75 kilometers to go. Today, fortunately, it doesn't really matter because that was about the same, because the stage was about 140 kilometers. Nicolau was the first over there, Samitier was second, and Tejada third. After 100 kilometers, there was also an intermediate sprint. Van Boven was the first over that, Rosen followed, and Lemmerizer was third. With 33 kilometers to go, the attacks started. The fugas, the various fugas de la fuga, started. Tiberi, Gregor, Samitier, Tejada, and Lemmerizer ended up being the last riders off the front till about 12 kilometers to go, when they were caught, as the wind gets up around us, starts to whip around our ears, Danny. They were caught with 12 kilometers to go. And just as they were, Juan Ayuso was getting dropped from the group of GC riders. This was under pressure from Red Bull. Incidentally, Visma, Lisa Bike, had been doing most of the pulling all day. With 10.8 kilometers to go, we had Pellizzari pulling on the front of the GC riders group, and the pace was going up. And in fact, it was around about this point when Felix Gall, who of course was he sixth on general classification before today? He's in that sort of a second tier of GC riders in the battle, really. I suppose for third place, he was. Was that before today, Danny?
It was after today, but let me check.
Before today, well, he was right in there with Pidcock and Hindley and Riccitello as well, battling for the podium. And he was dropped with 10.6 kilometres to go. 10.3 kilometres to go, we had another change on the front of the lead group, with Visma taking over with Tulet and Jorgensen. Gal was finally clawing, was starting to sort of claw his way back. He'd found his rhythm by that point. And the whole of the top 10 on GC indeed was back in the front group with 7 kilometers to go. Now, Danny and I, we drove this part of the course. So even before the final climb officially started, the race went through a narrow canyon, sheltered.
Mm-hmm. Which very was beautiful place.
Very beautiful. Yep. Through a couple of beautiful little pueblos. And it was torturous though, Danny, wasn't it? It was bendy, it was narrow, and it was a tough part of the race. With 6.7 kilometers to go, Gal was dropped again, Jorgensen was dropped again, and we had a further selection at the front. And this was pretty much the final big selection. 6.2 kilometers to go, Jai Hindley attacked. Pidcock was the first on his wheel, and Joao Almeida didn't initially react. He was cut adrift for a short while with Pellizzari on his wheel. With 5.5 kilometers to go, Riccitello attacked. And again, Almeida came back. We should say that Jonas Vingegaard was following most of the moves pretty comfortably, but he wasn't the aggressor himself really at any point today. Danny, what happened in the last 4 kilometers?
Well, right after the fourth kilometer to go, Giulio Pellizzari attacked, made his final, let's say, attacked, because it was so hard to follow for the rest of the riders, although Matthew Ricciatello tried so hard to follow him, but couldn't, so it was Pellizzari at the lead with five riders behind him. It was on live TV a conversation between Almeida and Vingegaard in that moment, which was something surprising to me, because they were talking like very calm way.
Yeah, and João Almeida was asked about this after the finish, and he said he was simply remarking to Jonas Vingegaard it was quite windy. It's quite windy.
Should we leave him?
It's quite windy. I think we should probably believe him. Of course, now I've got flashbacks to that moment. It was in the Itzulia this year, wasn't it, with João Almeida and Enric Mas, and Enric Mas asking João Almeida whether he would allow Mas to win the stage.
Yeah.
And what did João Almeida say in Spanish? I can't remember. It was something quite rude, wasn't it?
I cannot remember either.
Anyway, it was an emphatic no, Enric. Anyway, we don't know if that's what they were talking about today. We will assume not.
We're assuming not.
And shall we skip straight forward and give the listeners the result of the stage? Because there were small gaps then in the last few hundred metres. But Pellizzari certainly won the stage. Pidcock was the next best, second over the line, 16 seconds down. Hindley was 2 seconds further back in third place, 18 seconds down. Then another 2 seconds back, we had Vingegaard. Another 2 seconds after him, we had Almeida. Then 4 seconds behind Almeida was Ricciatello. And then there was a significant gap to Felix Gaut, who finished seventh, 53 seconds behind. With him was Torsten Tran of Bahrain victorious. Sepp Kuss was ninth, and Matteo Jorgensen was 10th. Danny, what did that mean for the general classification? Well, it meant that Jonas Vingegaard has now extended his lead by 2 seconds. He now leads João Almeida by 50 seconds. Tom Pidcock is third, 2:28 down. Jai Hindley is fourth, 3 minutes and 4 seconds down. Pellizzari is fifth, where he was this morning, but he's moved up in terms of time. He's now 3:51 down on Vingegaard. We now have Felix Gaut over a minute behind Pellizzari, 4:57, and Ricciatello only 2 seconds behind Felix Gaut. I'm going to stop there because I think that's as far as the riders who are really going for GC, as far as they're concerned, that's where it sort of ends. In the King of the Mountains competition, Jay Vine still leads. In the points competition, Mads Pedersen still leads. No major moves there. And in the white jersey competition, Pellizzari has extended his lead. He now leads Ricciatello by 1 minute and 8 seconds. Danny, I suggest that we leave it there as far as our summary is concerned, and we hear from some of the protagonists today. Firstly, we're going to hear from João Almeida. We're then going to hear from the Visma Lisa Bike Direct Sportive, Krisha Nieman, also talking about tomorrow's time trial in Valladolid. We're then going to hear from a rider we briefly mentioned in the Hamonometro, Juan Ayuso, who yet again was sort of missing in action on the final climb. He got dropped, I think we said, at 12 kilometres to go and was not seen again. And indeed, there weren't many UAE riders, climbers, we saw much of, except for João Almeida on that final climb. So I demanded an explanation from Juan Ayuso. I'm making this sound a lot more combative than it actually was. I simply asked Ayuso what happened to him today. Anyway, Almeida, Nieman, then Ayuso.
João, tell me if I'm wrong, but you look a little bit disappointed.
Not really. I'm just tired, like everybody else. But yeah, one less day to Madrid.
Big opportunities to gain time on Jonas Vingegaard. Can you tell us how the climb went for you?
I mean, it was quite steep at the first part. It was really hard. And then the second part was super windy, so nobody really wanted to spend more. So yeah, it was a tricky climb, and in the end, we almost arrived all together. Just some guys have a bit better sprint than the others.
But in the beginning of the climb, you let a little gap. Was it about like not having the legs, or was it just smart to take your own pace?
Nah, they were talking quite hard, and I knew it was not a sustainable pace for them, so I just put my pace, and I knew I would get them back. Yeah, today was really super windy, actually, and we were always changing direction, so sometimes it was headwind, sometimes it was crosswind, sometimes tailwind, so yeah, it was that nice actually. Just a pity that everything is dark from the fires a few weeks ago. So also say chapeau to all the fire people.
There we go.
Yeah. That's protect the place and the houses.
Now we'll ask again. I mean, clearly today you were isolated really early on. Jonas, I think, still had Tulit with him, and at one point, Kuss, I think, if I'm not mistaken, was that a danger? Was that, you know, Solaire attacking in the previous days, Vine and such?
If you see, the climb was quite hard, so after a little bit, I think we're all by ourselves. And I think it didn't change much.
What did we learn today?
That all the guys up there are about as strong as each other uphill.
What did you make of UAE?
Yeah, but I think it's Joao was alone on a climb of 12%, so that doesn't make the big difference. And of course, if Jonas would have had the legs, he would have attacked him there, but it wasn't possible apparently today.
How much did the wind, this kind of exposed climb, play a factor in the attacks or not having attacks?
Yeah, I mean, in the end, for sure, they knew it was super windy, especially on the last straight. That if you arrive there fully on the limit, you could also have a backlash on that, and for sure it might have held the sun back a little bit. That's why they stayed together for such a long time. But in the end, it is what it is. Jonas took a few seconds on Joao, and we have to call it a good day.
Grisha, are you broadly happy with the situation? If I'd have offered you this a week ago, would you have taken it?
Yeah, I mean, we would like to be in the jersey by 5 minutes and being able to say the world is already over. That's certainly not the case. There's a hard TT tomorrow. There's a very hard stage on Saturday. It is what it is. And we take being in the jersey by, I guess, now 50 seconds or something like that. So for sure, we take that.
And this morning we weren't sure whether we were going to have more disruption. Is that making things difficult for you, that you're having to plan for other scenarios?
Yeah, it makes things especially difficult for the riders. I mean, we in the team car, we can adapt to different scenarios. But telling the riders with 20k to go, the finish is not at the finish line, but it's at 8 kilometers like yesterday. I mean, they all take it in a good way. But that's, of course, complicated for the guys when they are racing with a heart rate of 200. But I think it is what it is. I think the Vuelta organizers, they try their utmost best to keep it safe, to have it a safe race for the riders. I'm happy we raced today without incidents, and I'm hoping, I'm praying that we can go on like this to Madrid.
And talking of accepting scenarios, would you accept status quo tomorrow if they finish on exactly the same time, or are you aiming higher than that?
Yeah, for sure I would accept that, but also in the TT, the goal is for Jonas to do a good time trial, and then we will see further. But I think when we can keep this status quo now, we have to be. Yep.
Well, I just wanted to ask you, how was your day, really? How did you feel out there today?
Well, I think it was a super hard day, and you know, always in these rows which are left and right, and always a bunch of them online, and you have to accelerate always at the bottom. So it was a super hard day, and then Red Bull put a super high pace, and I think they also did a bit of our job, because our job was also to, you know, to try and make a hard pace. So yeah, once Red Bull did it, then that pretty much set up the day.
And are you still finding your feelings are sort of one day good, one day not so good, and a little bit inconsistent still?
Yeah, also I'm suffering a bit of a cold. I think it's something common right now in this last week of the Vuelta for nearly all the peloton. But today I feel a bit better. Rest day was the worst. Yesterday I struggled a bit. Today I feel a bit better. Tomorrow I won't do the time trial really hard to try to recover a bit more. And I hope then for the last stages I'm ready.
One of the questions put to Christian Niemann there was, what did we learn today? I'm now going to ask you that question. What did we learn, Danny, today from this 17th stage?
I think that maybe some of the best riders of the GC are not in their best form at this point of the race, let's say. What do you think?
They're very closely matched. I mean, we heard Christian say there that they're very closely matched. We also heard him say that for that reason, UAE's lack of representation at the top of the final, well, in the last few kilometers of the final climb, was only sort of marginally relevant. I don't know whether I agree with him there, because we always think in terms of, well, having teammates, it helps because obviously, you know, you can be sheltered by your domestiques, and you can use them like a bit of a sort of remote control. You can vary the pace, ration your efforts to your whims and caprices, rather than being at the mercy of another team who dictates the pace. However, we often overlook other things. We overlook how they can give you a bottle, or they can give you some food, or maybe your radio is not working and they can radio back to the car on your behalf. We also overlook the moral support that they can give. And I do still maintain that if you look on paper at the resources that UAE have in this Vuelta a España, they have underperformed on the big mountain stages. And somewhere, I'm not saying it was definitely today, but somewhere over the last 2.5 weeks, João Almeida will have been penalised by that. That's my opinion.
Yeah. And right after the finish, I was just so close to Matteo Jorgensen and Sepp Kuss just talking while they were just changing clothes, and they were just not peace, of course, but they were expecting Jonas to win the stage. They were just saying that it would be great to have another outcome on the stage. So they were, of course, working for that goal to come.
Yes, so that's Visma and UAE. I mean, there's not much left in terms of battles in the mountains. We've got the Bolo del Mundo, basically, on Saturday. So this was a sort of finish line of sorts, and it has finished in a stalemate. Okay, Vingegaard gained those 2 seconds. And talking in terms of what we learned today, well, we didn't learn anything about João Almeida's style of climbing, the way he tends to get dropped and then tends to find his way back to Jonas Vingegaard. How relevant is that going to be on the Bolo del Mundo? I think we'll probably see a similar scenario to the one we saw today. I would be very surprised if he cracked completely. I think his performances today, probably when we look at the numbers, when we look at the watts, probably very much in line with what he's done so far. We've seen minimal differences between them. The big difference we saw was it wasn't Serlet. Which mountaintop finish was it? Just remind me. It was
Serlet, or the previous day you're talking about?
Was it Serlet? It was Serlet, wasn't it?
I think so, yeah.
It was Serlet. Which wasn't a particularly difficult climb, but Almeida was caught out at the bottom by Vingegaard's extremely high pace and not having teammates around him. So that's that. And that is, as far as the mountains are concerned, it's almost over. We may yet get crosswinds on Friday. That's another thing we need to consider as well. But a lot is going to be decided by tomorrow's time trial. So we'll talk a bit more, I guess, about that later on. Also in the battle for the podium positions, Tom Pidcock probably proves some analysts, experts wrong again today. People are expecting him, and I think I heard Perico Delgado on Spanish TV suggest that he thought that Pidcock would be vulnerable today on a very difficult climb like the one we had to the Moriadero, but he was very strong. And in fact, he was one of the most sort of the fastest to jump behind the moves today, wasn't he?
Yeah. And he was the second rider to cross the line just 16 seconds after Pelizzari. And I think we cannot blame Pedro Delgado or whoever just were thinking about this Pidcock version before the Vuelta, because that was what we were seeing about him just so many days, many stages, many Grand Tours before. So I think this is a surprising Pidcock for everybody, and I don't know, maybe even for him as a rider, he's surprised.
Yeah, big question marks over his time trialing tomorrow. I don't expect that he's necessarily had the resources put behind his time trialing that maybe Jai Hindley had. Obviously, Hindley's been at Red Bull and Bora for a few years now, and has also ridden good time trials in the past. I am expecting Hindley to be very good in the time trial tomorrow, as he has been on occasion in the past, and he's certainly looking very strong at the moment. I think it's going to be more difficult for Riccitello. I don't think he's had a lot of resources put behind his time trialing, I'm led to believe, over the past year or two. In fact, that might be a reason why he's leaving Israel Premier Tech at the end of the year. And obviously, with his small stature, I expect him to struggle. Felix Gall is not a dragon, as the Italians say, in time trials. So I think certainly in that battle for third place, and we shouldn't count out Pellizzari, who we're going to come to in a minute and talk about his stage win, but I think he will probably ride a decent time trial. But I see the main battle tomorrow in terms of third place is going to be between Hindley and Pidcock. Just before we move on to discuss Pellizzari, Danny, Juan Ayuso, we heard him say to me that he wasn't feeling very well, he'd been ill. It was a hard part of the race when he was dropped. He was by no means the only sort of mountain domestique who was dropped that part of the race. I believe you've been speaking to people at the finish, just, you know, we don't need to name them, just off the record, but you might have gleaned a bit more info just about the Juan Ayuso situation in general, which of course was the big story, well, at the start of last week. We know that we learned last week that he's leaving UAE at the end of the year. We think he's going to Little Trek. That whole storyline has been overshadowed by other events yesterday, and we've kind of taken our eye off it. But I believe you did learn a little bit more this afternoon.
Yeah, I think what we can say is that, Juan Ayuso, of course, is not happy with the GC, but he was not expecting himself to do a great GC because he didn't make the altitude camp or wherever the preparation needs to be done. But at this point, what we learned is that he's not very happy because Rwanda World Championship is coming and he has not done the altitude camp neither for that. So, because he's here in La Vuelta. So, I don't know, it's a very, let's say, complicated situation for Ayuso and his entourage, let's say. So let's see how the outcome is coming.
And as far as UAE is concerned, Danny, did you learn a little bit more this afternoon about maybe the moment, the point at which the relationship, I don't want to say turned sour, but the idea that Juan Ayuso was going to leave UAE, it started to germinate in his mind and the mind maybe of his entourage?
I don't know if it was the Finnish turning point of many, let's say, but it's pretty easy to say that it was a Giro stage, especially if we're talking about the Sterrato stage in the Giro. I don't remember the number of the stage, but that day probably was the Finnish turning point for Ayuso and his relationship with the
what
team
happened?
With UAE. It's a very complicated situation.
You can't say much. Maybe we'll just slowly kind of leak out the details of that in the next few days, just a drop at a time. Anyway, that was Juan Ayuso today, who, as we said, was unfortunately for him, not unfortunately for Joao Almeida, not able to offer much assistance on the final climb. One rider who didn't need too much assistance, and in fact he was trying to assist his team leader and he did that, but he also found time to win the stage, was Giulio Pellizzari, who today took his first Grand Tour stage win. And he's only 21 years of age. He's already finished second, of course, on a Giro d'Italia stage, the stage that went over Monte Grappa in the Giro d'Italia last year. And, well, what an impressive victory it was. After the finish up here on El Morero, I spoke to his direct sportive, Pachi Vila, about how he directed Pellizzari on the final climb, and also just about how promising a rider he is generally, as he demonstrated today. Here's Pachi Vila.
Well, Pachi, you obviously had a couple of things to think about on that final climb. Jai, his GC position, Giulio winning the stage in the end. Just tell me exactly what instructions did you give them on the last climb?
Well, actually having two options in the stage, in the win, in the game, you need to try to win the stage, you know. And then, of course, having Jai was followed by Pidcock, by all the GC guys, and Giulio has a bit more of freedom, so we just move him for that. That's it, you know. We have a stage win, which is good with Giulio. Jai is still fighting for the podium, so I think we have to be happy.
And, well, presumably Giulio got the freedom to attack there when Jai realised he couldn't drop the others. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, you know. Once we got to the after the steep part on the flat, then it's about also putting pressure on the other, I mean, attacking with a second guy needs that you put pressure also on the rivals from Jai, so Jai needs to follow, you know. So basically it's an easier position also for him, and that's what it's normally with when you have two guys that are in front. Yeah.
Just on Giulio, in Italy he has this because of his personality, because he's larger than life, he has the reputation of having his head a little bit in the clouds, but how talented is this kid?
I mean, if you look what he has done today or what he did in also in the Giro, I think his talent is already there. You know, we know that he's a damn good bike rider, that he has a very bright future in front of him, and now we're just going step by step with him. You know, I think he's progressing in the right way. He's just on a nice path. So we need just to enjoy him how he is. He's a fresh guy. He's always smiley. He always have that nice aura, I would say. So we need to enjoy him.
Danny, I know that our good friend Pelacci, Michele Pelacci, will have been watching the Vuelta today, and he'll have been chortling at what he saw. Giulio Pellizzari putting on a bit of a tour de force. I'm sure today, in the mind of Pelacci, constituted real ciclismo. But Giulio Pellizzari has got stronger and stronger in this race, as I've said before, and as I also said a few minutes ago, he did two jobs today, because he did everything that Jai Hindley could have wanted, and then he was able to sort of take advantage of the stalemate between those other GC riders, and indeed Jai Hindley was able to take advantage of Pellizzari going away, and I expect him also, Pellizzari, to ride a very good time trial tomorrow. But he's a guy that Red Bull, Bora, Hansa Grohe are going to have to accommodate in their thinking about Grand Tours next year. We don't know what's happening with Primoz Roglic next year. There's been a lot of speculation about him leaving the team. We're still really none the wiser about that. What I can tell you is that there are riders in the peloton who are looking for contracts, who might be able to find contracts at Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe, and they've been told there might be another space, another slot opening up. Now, who could that mean? Who could be leaving Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe? Could it be Roglic? There's been speculation in the Spanish media in the last few days about Oyer Lazcano, who has not raced since Paris-Roubaix. No one seems to know what's happening with Lazcano. Could he be leaving early, well before the end of his contract with Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe? There's a third rider who might be leaving and who should have been or is under contract, and that's Vlasov, who might be going back to Astana. But of course, Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe have Evenepoel arriving. They have Roglic at present. They have Pellizzari, and they also have Lipovic, and that's not to even talk about guys like Dani Martinez. So, Danny, all very intriguing.
Yeah, it is. Everything is intriguing, but especially all what is happening, let's say, with the Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe team.
Indeed, I'm just looking at their roster for next year, who is officially under contract. Martinez is still under contract, and Vlasov is still under contract. So someone is going to, I would suggest, or might be leaving early. Danny, I think that really concludes what we've got to say about the racing this afternoon, and we are going to pivot now to have what we usually have at the end of part two, and that is the Encuentro del Día. As announced yesterday, this week the theme is going to be riders who have their own sort of social media side hustle. Yesterday it was Ivan Cortina, who every night is doing an Instagram live in which he talks about the race. This morning, the victim of the Encuentro del Día was EF Education First James Shaw, who a short while ago, or a few months ago, launched his own YouTube channel, which, by all accounts, is going pretty well, proving pretty popular. Anyway, I sought out James this morning to ask him exactly why he started his YouTube channel and how it is all going. Here is the Encuentro del Día.
El Encuentro del Día, the meeting of the day.
Well, James, every day on the Worlds we have a meeting of the day, and there's a theme this week, and it is riders who have got a bit of a, I hope you don't think this is disrespectful, a side hustle on social media in various different ways. Now, your YouTube channel has been going for a while. Just tell me, why did you set it up in the first place? How did you set it up? And yeah, what the, well, what were the reasons for setting up?
Yeah, so 7 months ago now, we, myself and a friend, got together and sort of had this idea of, actually there's nobody that has a YouTube channel that shows the inside of cycling. They're all either teams or influencers that become cyclists, as opposed to cyclists that become influencers, if that's the best way to put it. So we had this vision of trying to bring not the dark side of cycling to people, but the maybe the unglorified truth to the people a little bit. So we set up the channel, the two of us, in the hope of sort of showing people the what actually goes on, as opposed to the, I mean, it is rock and roll, it is cool, it is, you know, glory, but it's not, there's a underlying reality to it as well.
As someone who works in the media, I'm probably more interested than most in the nuts and bolts, the boring bits of it, the practicalities. So you did a video, for example, the other day where you are vlogging from here. Just talk about the practicalities of it, for example, on the rest day. I mean, that must be quite onerous.
Effectively, we set it up and it cost us money to make the videos. It cost us more money to make them than the videos make us. Unlike a lot of, I guess, mainstream influencers where they can have a lot of, say, like... they can have a bike sponsor. We can't really do that because I'm personally contracted with a brand anyway, so we can't sell the space that maybe other channels can sell. We're very restricted in. We're very reliant on views and subscribers and Google AdSense for the majority of the income, which isn't a lot. I also want to do it in a way that I'm not like shoving a camera under someone's nose in the bus while they're trying to get their shorts on, sort of thing. You know, I want to be respectful about it to other people as well. It's often quite difficult to try and get things together, but it seems to be working. We've got our first video over 10,000 views the other day as well, which we did before we left to come here, and I think we're finding our stride a bit more with it now.
When you talk about we, just give your friend the credit that he or she deserves.
Yeah, so there's myself and Lewis, and he does occasionally make an appearance, so you'll see him in the odd video here and there, but effectively Lewis, I do all the video in, and Lewis does everything else. He does all the editing, he does all the captions, he does all the dealing with the sponsors and things like that. So we have our collaboration with Whoop, we also have VO have come on board, which is the nose strips, things like that, so... He does everything while I do. I just film myself, or my wife films me, or whatever. Yeah, Lewis is the engine, as you like, to the car, where I'm just sort of the pretty exterior on the outside, as it was.
I think you talk about cars on there quite a bit, because that's a bit of a passion of yours. James, just quickly then, if people haven't seen your channel, and you could recommend one video that they should watch to give them an idea, or a video that you particularly enjoyed making, what would it be?
That's a tough one, yeah, I don't know. Any of them, really, like take your pick, they're all different, done in a different way. My wife's in some of them as well, she's getting on board, people seem to like her. I think they seem to like the rawness of it, or sort of the fact that it's not fancy at all, it's very realistic sort of thing, and I think people like enjoy the fact that actually they can relate to the majority of it. It's a rather normal lifestyle sort of thing.
Gritty kitchen sink drama. James, last one then. What have you learned? What have you learned? I don't know, maybe about the media or social media in the course of doing this.
Whatever video you make, I'm going to get an email from somebody saying they don't like something, or somebody from the team said that's not right, or that's not right. Somebody somewhere, you can't please all people all of the time.
I can vouch for that.
Before the break, we heard from James Short about his YouTube channel. A recommended watch, I would suggest. We are relieved. We're delighted that we did get a full race today. Danny, just to say that when we did drive through Ponferrada was, what was it, 30 kilometers from the finish today, and that was the closest main city. We were slightly anxious about what might be going on, having seen what happened yesterday and the effect it had on the race. There was a protest, there was a demonstration at the side of the road in Ponferrada. It wasn't of the same volume, same dimensions as yesterday's, and hence we did have the stage that we expected to have. Obviously, there are big concerns about tomorrow's time trial in Valladolid, which we're going to talk about in a minute. We're going to talk about the course and cycling matters, but it being a time trial, obviously the individual riders are going to be exposed tomorrow, and Valladolid is a big city. It's the capital of the autonomous community of Castilla y León. So there are going to be bigger crowds tomorrow, and there are some concerns about that. Danny, I believe the Valladolid police today were communicating on Twitter what they've been saying.
Yeah, they were just saying, I mean, giving rules to the people to be peaceful or have a peaceful relationship tomorrow with La Vuelta, but everything was just as the original course was planned. But I'm checking now on Twitter, Daniel, that a Spain left-wing party, Podemos, is going to block the time trial tomorrow, and the police officers has reinforced the security tomorrow with 1,000 more agents. So
okay, they are calling upon their supporters. Yep. Podemos.
Yep.
Okay. Danny, we expect the time trial to go ahead. We certainly hope it goes ahead as planned. Let's talk, shall we? Well, we're going to talk first of all very briefly about last night's dinner, and then we're going to talk about tomorrow's time trial and a couple of the riders who will be hoping for a good result.
La etapa de mañana, la cena de ayer. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's food.
Yesterday's dinner was, we were still in Rivero, we were in Rivadavia, which was the town where we were for dinner the other night. We were in a different restaurant. Where were we? It was called Chamón.
Chamón e Ribeiro. I think so, right?
Yes, I think that's right. So when, if ever, you're in Galicia and you see an X, so we have Chamón instead of Jamón, the X is generally pronounced like a sh in English. That's right, isn't it, Danny?
Yeah, it is.
Okay.
Salmon.
And we had some nice Ribeiro wine. Again, well, I did. Danny, sober as a judge, yet again. Just water for him. But I had a nice, lovely white wine. We said the previous day, I think, that about 90% of the grapes grown in the Ribeiro DO region are white. But there's also a very nice red wine. But had a glass of the white as an aperitivo. And then, Danny, what did we eat? You ate octopus, which, of course, in Galicia is very much prized and vaunted.
Yeah. It was good. It was not the best one I've ever tried, but it was good. But my favorite thing yesterday dinner was the...
The company.
Yeah, apart from the company, the thing I have on my phone screen right now, what do you think about it?
Is the jamón,
but especially the queso, the cheese we ate yesterday. It was so good for me. So that would be my selection from yesterday.
Did you know exactly what the cheese was?
No idea at all.
We didn't. It was a dry cheese, but it was very good. It was very delicious. Danny, tomorrow, as I said, we're in Valladolid. What can we tell the listeners about tomorrow's time trial and the course?
Tomorrow's time trial is 27 kilometers long. It's a very, very flat team trial, just a street with 500 meters with a 7.3 gradient, I think. But yeah, it's not.
The organizers have a very peculiar looking, a very misleading, I would suggest, looking profile that they've published with a tiny, tiny bump. It literally looks like a speed bump. Yep. However, if you look at the scale down the side and you look at the altitude, you realize that it may actually be a lot more significant than that profile suggests. 27.2 kilometers. Of course, we had a time trial in Valladolid couple of years ago in the Vuelta a España. That was won, if I'm not mistaken, and I'm looking it up,
Pipo.
It was won by Pipo, by Filippo Ganna. It was slightly longer, wasn't it? It was shorter. It was 25 kilometers, and it was won by 16 seconds and by Filippo Ganna, 16 seconds ahead of Remco Evenepoel. Third was Primoz Roglic, 35 seconds behind, and fourth was João Almeida. And he finished 49 seconds behind Pipo Ganna. And 10th was a certain Jonas Vingegaard. 1 minute and 17 seconds behind Ganna. So quick math, Danny, that put him...
42 seconds, right? After Almeida, let's say.
28, Danny.
28 seconds. Oh, I was just looking.
28 seconds.
Not where I made it was.
Yes.
I'm good at maths, I promise.
28 seconds. We're going to say about half a minute. Should that happen tomorrow, well, that would make things very intriguing indeed, because we'll remind you that the gap between them on general classification is 50 seconds. The two teams have a sort of intriguing record in time trials this year. They've had some good days when the whole team has performed very well. Visma had that at the Dauphiné, for example, and that was quite a hilly time trial. And they've had days when various riders in the team have performed below expectations, as occurred in the Tour de France this year. I've said on several occasions in the last couple of months that the UAE time trial setup is reputed among people who know about these things to be very fast on fast flat courses. So I'm loath to make a prediction. If I had to predict, I would predict that Joao Almeida will be slightly better than Jonas Vingegaard tomorrow, but not by much, and certainly not by 50 seconds. That would be my prediction.
No. I'm thinking exactly the same. I think. Well, I don't know if. No. Let's give you the contradict thing. I'm going to bet about Jonas for tomorrow in this battle between him and Joao. And I was checking the Pellizzari results at the team time trials of the the individual time trials of the Giro, and he was just 30 seconds behind John Tallin in one of them, but on the other one, he was more than 2 minutes behind Dan Hull, who was the winner that day. So it's going to be a very interesting.
He certainly has the body for a good, that you would associate with good time trials, but it's very early in his career. I think, I'm pretty sure he did go to the track in Palma de Mallorca with Johnny Whale and Dan Bigham, who are the guys who look after aerodynamics and time trialing at Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe. I'm pretty sure he did spend a day there in the winter in January when I was there, in fact. But yes, we shall see tomorrow. I'm just looking, I wanted to bring up a comparison of Tom Pidcock and Jai Hindley in time trials, but I'm struggling with that at the moment. But as mentioned earlier, that is also going to be very interesting, because Hindley is a significant amount of time behind. I'm just going to bring up general classification again. He is over a minute behind on general classification. No, he's not. Sorry. He is 36 seconds behind on general classification. I think that's going to be really close at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. I'm going to make another prediction. I think Jai Hindley will be in third place on general classification at the end of tomorrow's stage.
I do agree on that.
Okay.
Yep.
We're in agreement on that. The final thing to predict is who's going to win the stage. Is it going to be Pipo Ganna? Or I'm going to throw another one into the mix purely because we've got an interview with him that we're going to hear in just a minute. Stefan Kung.
Let's go with Ganna.
Okay, you're going with Ganna. I'm going to go with Stefan Kung. And we're going to play out tonight, in fact, with Stefan Kung, an interview I did with him a few days ago. Not really about tomorrow's time trial, but about why he decided that he's going to leave his current team, Groupama, at the end of the year. And he's going home, so to speak, to a Swiss team. That's Tudor Pro Cycling, where he'll be we hope he'll be a teammate next year of our good friend Larry Warbass, who of course currently rides for Tudor, and who knows, may ride for them again next year. So here is Stefan Kung talking about why he's changing teams. Danny, we are going to change locations because we are going to head now down the mountain towards Leon. Thanks, Danny.
Thank you. See you tomorrow.
But Stefan, after many, many years, I didn't count them, I didn't look it up, at Groupama, you are moving, you're going home next year, Tudor. Just talk to me about the reasons why.
Yeah, I've spent seven good years here in Groupama FDJ, but I always knew I'm not going to end my career in this team. It's not nothing against the team, just I wanted to see something differently, and that's what I was looking for. I just felt like, yeah, my time here has come to an end, and it was time to move on, make another step in my career, and I wanted an environment which is challenging, which is dynamic and on the rise, and that's what's happening at Tudor. Like, it's a team that invested heavily in the structure before acquiring top tier riders, and they want to build their own talent, but to be able to do that, they also need some riders with experience that are still performing at the highest level, and that's why we find each other.
I think I'm right in saying that the last time you renewed your contract, there was quite a lot of speculation as well about whether you would stay or whether you would go. You eventually decided to stay. With hindsight, do you think that was a good decision, or maybe you should have moved earlier?
Oh, it's hard to say. In the end, I'm one that's loyal to the contracts that you agreed upon, and I agreed to another 3 years after 2022. And so now these 3 years are over, and it's time to move on. For sure, sometimes you have these clauses in your contract that you might leave and so on. But I also felt with all the big investment that the team and Villiers did for the TT bike last year and so on, it didn't feel right to leave already this year. And so I wanted to end my time here at the team on a positive note, because I've spent 7 good years. I was able to grow a lot as a rider. I was able to take the responsibility on the classics and have a lot of nice results and victory in these colors.
What do you think the next phase, you'll be leaving of course, but the next phase of this team looks like? Because they seem to have, after the sort of internationalization, now they've got a lot of good young French riders, and it seems to be becoming a very French team again.
Yeah, I mean, in the end, I also still follow what they are doing, and so far, yeah, that's something obvious, because when you look at the rider roster for next year, it's a big majority is French, but I know that a lot of things are going on behind the scenes at the team. They are in a phase of restructuring. I mean, they're really big, like cornerstone riders like Arnaud Demare and Thibaut Pinot. They either left the team or retired, and they had a good generation of young riders, but when it was time to re-sign them, they were tempted elsewhere, and so now they are in this phase of restructuring, but for sure they're not like giving up or just finding their niche. They want to be one of the best teams in the world, and maybe they will in the next years as well. I will follow it closely, that's for sure.
The very last thing, so I know you've got to go. What's what are the last items on the bucket list, you can call it, for your career that you want to tick off in order for you to be happily retired?
I would love to win a Tour de France stage, and I would love to win a big one-day classics.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Byrne.